Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're plunging into a topic that's just fundamental, money and banking.
Right.
You probably think you know money. It's, you know, what's in your wallet, your bank account. Mm. Simple.
Seems simple, yeah.
But what if I told you money is constantly being created and destroyed, and how it flows? Well, it affects pretty much everything. Groceries, global markets, you name it.
It really does. It's this huge, complex system humming away beneath the surface.
So our mission today is to sort of cut through that complexity. We want to show you how money's really made, how it moves around, and the big levers that control the whole economy.
And the fascinating thing is how all these concepts, they directly hit your world, whether you notice it day to day or not.
Exactly.
We want to give you those sharp insights, those moments where it just clicks, so you feel, you know, genuinely clued in on something that often feels kind of overwhelming, full of jargon.
Okay, let's start right at the beginning then. A question that sounds simple, but maybe isn't. What is money? Really?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, why do we even use it?
It's a great starting point.
Because if you strip it all back, beyond the coins and the apps, the formal definition is something like anything generally accepted as a medium of exchange for goods and services.
That's the textbook definition, yeah. But the real aha is understanding why that works. What problems does it actually solve?
Right.
Think about barter. And imagine trying to trade, I don't know, your amazing handcrafted pottery for bread.
Okay.
But the baker, they don't need pottery, they need shoes. It's just messy, inefficient.
Yeah, the double coincidence of wants problem.
Exactly. Money just cuts through all that. It's the medium of exchange. Makes buying and selling smooth.
Okay. Function one. What else?
Well, it's also a unit of account, a common measuring stick. How else do you compare the value of, say, a house to a laptop without money?
Good point. Apples and oranges otherwise.
Totally. And then, crucially, it's a store of value. It lets you save your purchasing power for later. Assuming prices stay reasonably stable, of course.
Right, inflation's a whole other beast we'll get to.
Yeah, we will. And the last big one is standard of deferred payment. This is huge for our modern economy. It means we can borrow and lend. You can sign a contract today to pay back money next year because we agree on its value over time.
And for all that to work, money itself needs certain qualities, doesn't it? Like, it can't just be anything.
No, definitely not. It has to be durable. You know, not fall apart. Portable, easy to carry. Divisible, you need to be able to make change.
Uniform, right? A dollar is a dollar.
Yep, uniform. Acceptable, everyone has to agree to take it. And, this is key, limited supply. If it grew on trees, it wouldn't be worth anything.
They're like a common language for trade, almost.
Yeah.
Everyone needs to agree on the rules.
Precisely.
Okay, so, we know what money is, functionally. But then, how much of it is actually floating around out there? That gets us to the money supply.
Right. The total amount of monetary assets in an economy at any given time. And economists, well, they measure this in a few different ways. It's not just one number.
How so?
We talk about narrow money, usually called M1. That's the most liquid stuff. Think cash in circulation, the money in your checking account, your current account. Stuff you can spend, like, right now.
Instantly available. Got it.
Then we broaden it out. M2, or sometimes M3, depending on the country. This adds M1 to things that are almost money. Savings accounts, time deposits, maybe money market funds.
So a bit less liquid, but still pretty easy to get to.
Exactly. It's a spectrum. And these different measures, M1, M2, they tell us slightly different things about spending habits, economic activity, maybe potential inflation down the line.
And somewhere in this picture is the central bank, right? Keeping an eye on it all.
Oh, absolutely. The central bank is critical in controlling, or at least influencing, this supply.
Mm.
We'll definitely talk more about their tools, interest rates, reserve requirements.
Okay, good. Because, you know, it's not just how much money exists, it's also about how fast it's moving, its speed.
That's a perfect transition.
Which brings us to a really core idea for linking money and prices, the quantity theory of money, usually shown as that equation, MV equals PT. Or sometimes PY.
Ah, yes, the famous equation. Let's break that down for you.
Please do.
M is the money supply, whatever measure we're using, M1 or M2. V is the velocity of circulation.
How fast the money changes hands.
Exactly. Think of a $20 bill. You spend it on lunch. The restaurant owner uses that same $20 to pay a supplier. The supplier uses it to pay an employee, all within, say, a week. That one, $20, supported $60 of transactions. That's V in action.
Okay.
Then P is the overall price level in the economy. And T, or sometimes Y, is the volume of transactions, or the economy's real output, the actual goods and services produced.
So MV equals P par T, money times speed equals price times transactions.
Right. And the core idea, especially pushed by economists like Milton Friedman, the monetarists, is that if V velocity and T, or Y real output, are relatively stable or predictable.
Which is a big if.
It is a big if, especially for V. But if they are stable, then changes in M, the money supply, lead directly to proportional changes in P, the price level. More money chasing the same amount of goods means.
Inflation. Prices go up.
Bingo. Now that's the theory. Elegant, isn't it? But it does raise that question you hinted at. How well does this simple relationship hold up in our messy, complex, modern economy?
Yeah, because I feel like I've heard that velocity V isn't actually that stable.
Right.
Especially recently.
You're absolutely right. In the real world, particularly since, say, the 2008 financial crisis, velocity has become much more volatile, much harder to predict.
Why is that?
Lots of reasons. Financial innovation changes how quickly money moves. People's saving and spending habits change, especially in uncertain times. Low interest rates might make people hoard cash instead of spending it. So while MVPT shows a fundamental link, just looking at M to predict P, it's gotten way more complicated. Velocity is the wild card.
Okay, that makes sense. So with all this theory swirling around, what does it actually mean for, you know, us, our daily lives, the banks we use every day, commercial banks? They seem to be where the rubber meets the road.
They really are. Commercial banks are the engine room for most people's finances. They do several absolutely key things.
Like?
Well, first, obviously, accepting deposits. Your checking account, savings account, fixed deposits, they hold your money.
Okay, basic stuff.
Basic, but essential. Then the other side of the coin, lending money. Overdrafts, personal loans, business loans, mortgages, they provide the credit that fuels a lot of economic activity.
Right.
They also offer investment services, managing assets for clients, and crucial behind the scenes, cash management. Making sure they have enough actual cash for withdrawals, meeting regulations.
And they connect savers and borrowers, right. That intermediary role.
Exactly. That's maybe their most fundamental economic role. Intermediation, channeling funds from those who have surplus savings to those who need to borrow for consumption or investment. They make the whole system work.
And they have rules they have to follow, right? These ratios you hear about.
Yes, vital ones. Two main ones to understand. First is the reserve ratio or reserve requirement. This is the percentage of deposits that banks must hold in reserve. They cannot lend this portion out.
Set by the central bank.
Usually, yes. The key control tool. Then there's the capital ratio. This compares the bank's own capital, its cushion, against its risk-weighted assets. It's all about ensuring the bank is stable and can absorb potential losses. Financial stability depends on it.
And for the bank itself, they're always juggling a few goals, aren't they?
Three main ones, typically. Liquidity. Having enough cash or easily sellable assets to meet immediate obligations, like withdrawals. Security. Making sure their loans and investments aren't too risky. And of course, profitability. They need to earn income, mostly from the difference between the interest they pay on deposits and the interest they charge on loans.
Okay, now, here's something I've always found fascinating, maybe even a bit mind-bending. This idea of credit creation. Banks don't just move money around, they actually create it.
This is the big one, the real aha moment for understanding modern banking. Yes, through the process of lending, commercial banks effectively create new money.
How does that even work? It sounds like magic.
It feels like magic, but it stems from that fractional reserve system we mentioned. Banks only hold a fraction of deposits in reserve. Let's say the reserve ratio is 10%.
Okay.
You deposit $100. The bank holds $10 in reserve. It can then lend out the other $90.
Right.
Now, when they make that $90 loan, they don't usually hand over cash. They credit the borrower's account with $90. Poof. New digital money has just been created, increasing the total money supply.
Whoa.
And it doesn't stop there. The person who borrowed the $90 spends it. The recipient deposits it into their bank. That bank keeps 10%, $9, and lends out the remaining $81.
And that $81 is new money again.
Exactly. And that $81 gets spent, deposited, 90% gets lent out again. The process repeats. It's a chain reaction.
So that initial $100 deposit can lead to much more money in the system overall.
Precisely. That's the power of credit creation. What limits it is that reserve ratio, people's willingness to borrow, and banks' willingness to lend, and ultimately the central bank's influence.
Is there a way to calculate that expansion?
Yep. There's a simple formula called the bank credit multiplier or money multiplier. It's just 1 divided by the reserve ratio.
So if the ratio is 10% or 0.1?
The multiplier is 1.1, which equals 10.
Meaning that initial $100 deposit could potentially support up to $1,000 of total money in the system. $100 initial plus $900 created credit.
In theory, yes. That's the maximum potential expansion under Simplify assumptions. It shows how powerful this mechanism is. Banks aren't just passive keepers of money. They actively expand the supply through lending.
That is genuinely profound. Okay, so commercial banks are creating money through loans. But they aren't the only players influencing the overall money supply, especially in a global economy.
Yeah.
What else shifts the amount of money out there?
Great question. There are several other major forces. The big one, as we hinted, is the role of the central bank. They control the base money or monetary base.
How do they do that?
They have several tools. Setting the main interest rate, like the Fed funds rate in the US or bank rate in the UK, influences borrowing costs throughout the economy. Changing reserve requirements directly impacts how much banks can lend. And a major tool is open market operations. Buying government bonds injects money into the system. Selling bonds withdraws it.
Okay, central bank is key. What else?
Government deficit financing. When a government spends more than it taxes, it borrows. If it borrows heavily from the central bank or commercial banks, that can directly increase the money supply. It's like injecting spending power directly.
Right. I've heard about QE2, quantitative easing. What's that about?
Quantitative easing, QE. We saw a lot of this after 2008 and during the pandemic. It's basically when the central bank buys up large amounts of financial assets, often government bonds, but sometimes other things from banks and financial institutions.
Why do they do that?
The main goal is to inject massive amounts of liquidity into the system, push down longer-term interest rates, and encourage lending and investment, especially when short-term rates are already near zero and the economy is struggling. It's a powerful, if somewhat controversial, tool.
Controversial how?
Well, debates about whether it fuels asset bubbles, increases inequality, or could eventually lead to high inflation.
I got it. And one more. You mentioned the global economy.
Yes, the balance of payments. In an open economy, international trade and capital flows matter. If a country runs a trade surplus, exporting more than importing foreign currency flows in. When this is converted to domestic currency, it increases the domestic money supply.
And a trade deficit does the opposite.
Exactly. A deficit means money is flowing out to pay for imports, which can reduce the domestic money supply. So yeah, global interactions definitely play a part.
Wow, okay. So many factors influencing the money supply. Which brings us inevitably to inflation. If the money supply grows too fast or demand just gets too hot, prices rise. How do policymakers try to cool things down?
Yeah.
Especially demand-driven inflation.
They have a toolkit primarily divided into three categories. First, monetary policy. This is the central bank's domain.
Raising interest rates.
That's the main one. Higher rates make borrowing more expensive for businesses and consumers, which should dampen spending and investment demand. They can also sell bonds through open market operations to actively pull liquidity out of the banking system.
Okay, monetary policy. What's next?
Fiscal policy. This is the government side taxing and spending. To reduce demand, the government can cut its own spending, which directly lowers overall demand. Or it can raise taxes, which reduces people's disposable income, leading to less consumer spending.
Makes sense. Cut spending or raise taxes. And the third?
Supply-side policies. Now, these aren't about directly squashing demand. They aim to make the economy more efficient and productive in the long run. Things like deregulation, investing in infrastructure, education, technology. By reducing production costs and increasing capacity, they can help ease price pressures, especially cost-push inflation where costs are rising.
So, different tools for potentially different problems. Monetary and fiscal for demand, supply side more for efficiency and costs.
Broadly speaking, yes. Those supply side policies take much longer to have an effect.
It sounds like they have options, but we often see inflation sticking around.
Yeah.
Why is it so hard to get it perfectly under control sometimes?
The million-dollar question. Several reasons. First, figuring out the exact cause is tricky. Is it too much demand? Is it supply chain shocks? The policy response needs to match the cause.
Okay.
Then there are time lags. Monetary policy, especially, takes time to work its way through the economy. A rate hike today might not fully impact spending and inflation for, say, 12 to 18 months. It's not like flipping a switch.
So you might overshoot or undershoot.
Exactly. And public expectations are huge. If everyone believes inflation will stay high, workers demand higher wages, businesses raise prices preemptively, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, very hard to break.
Psychology matters.
Immensely. Plus, you need good coordination between the central bank, monetary, and the government, fiscal. If they're pulling in opposite directions, Policies can cancel each other out. It's like trying to steer a giant ship you turn the wheel, but the response is slow and influenced by many currents.
That's a great analogy. Okay, let's shift focus slightly back to the individual level. Why do you, the listener, actually hold money? Why keep cash or money in a checking account instead of investing every last bit?
A fundamental question. And John Maynard Keynes gave us a really useful framework for this with his liquidity preference theory.
Liquidity preference, meaning the preference for holding liquid assets, like cash.
Precisely. Keynes suggested three main motives. The first is the transaction motive.
Yeah.
Simple enough, you need cash for everyday buying and selling. Groceries, coffee, bus fare, regular expenses.
Makes sense. What's the second?
The precautionary motive. This is about holding money just in case. For unexpected expenses, emergencies, the car breaks down, you have a sudden medical bill, it's your safety buffer.
The rainy day fund.
Exactly. And the third one is perhaps the most interesting, the speculative motive.
Speculative? How so?
This is about holding cash as an alternative to other assets, like bonds, based on expectations about future interest rates or asset prices. If you think interest rates are about to rise, bond prices will fall. So you might prefer to hold cash now to avoid that loss, or maybe to buy those bonds cheaper later, or you hold cash waiting for the stock market to dip.
So you're speculating on future market movements by holding cash.
Right. You're sacrificing potential returns now for perceived safety or future opportunity. Keynes also talked about a potential liquidity trap here.
What's that?
It's a situation where interest rates are already incredibly low, so low that people just prefer to hold cash because they expect rates can only go up, meaning bond prices will fall. In that trap, injecting more money into the economy via monetary policy might not work because people just hoard the cash instead of spending or investing it.
Fascinating. Okay, so that's why we hold money. Building on that, what determines the price of holding or borrowing money, the interest rate? This affects everything from mortgages to savings accounts.
Another huge topic. And there are two main schools of thought here, often presented as alternatives.
Okay.
First, there's the loanable funds theory. This is more of a classical or neoclassical view. It says the interest rate is determined in the market for loans by the interaction of the supply of savings.
People and firms saving money.
Right. And the demand for investment funds.
Businesses wanting to borrow to invest in projects.
Exactly. So it's the supply of funds, saving, and the demand for funds, investment, that determines the price of the interest rate. It's seen as a real phenomenon driven by saving and investment decisions.
Okay, supply and demand for loans. What's the other view?
The Keynesian theory, sometimes called the liquidity preference theory of interest. Keynes argued differently. He said the interest rate is determined by the supply of money,
which is influenced heavily by the central bank.
Correct. And the demand for money, which is driven by those three motives we just discussed. Transaction, precautionary, and speculative are liquidity preference.
So in Keynes' view, it's about the market for money itself, not necessarily loans for investment.
Precisely. It's the price that balances the desire to hold wealth in liquid form, money, with the available supply of money. It's a monetary view, contrasting with the real view of loanable funds.
So one focuses on saving and investment flows, the other on the stock of money and the desire to hold it.
That's a great way to summarize the key difference. Both theories offer valuable insights, and in reality, both real factors, like investment opportunities, and monetary factors, like central bank actions and liquidity preferences, clearly influence interest rates. It's complex.
Absolutely. What a journey we've been on. We started just trying to define money, looked at its core functions, then dove into how banks operate, how they actually create credit.
That multiplier effect is key.
Definitely. Then we broadened out to the central banks, government actions, QE, global flows affecting the money supply.
Tackled inflation and the policies used to fight it.
Right, and why it's so tricky. And finally, looked at why you hold money liquidity preference and the competing ideas about what sets interest rates. It really feels like we've fast-tracked understanding a vital but often opaque part of our world.
And I really hope you, the listener, can see how all these pieces fit together. Money supply, banks, interest rates, inflation. They're not separate boxes. They're all part of one dynamic system. Understanding even the basics like credit creation or the motives for holding money genuinely helps you make sense of the financial news and maybe even your own financial decisions.
Absolutely. So here's a final thought to leave you with. The next time you hear a news report about the central bank changing interest rates or worrying about inflation, Think back to this. How might understanding the bank credit multiplier change how you see lending? How might knowing about the speculative motive influence your view on why people are holding cash? Does understanding potential policy lags make you view economic forecasts differently?
Keep asking those questions.
Keep that curiosity going. Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive.